Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and I'm delighted to say that we're on episode 2 of our new series, which is South American cities. Gary, where are we tonight?
We're in Argentina and we're just outside Buenos Aires in the city of Avellaneda.
Brilliant.
It's not because there's another road outside.
It just came to me.
So I'm fine.
Yeah, I had a little bit of a panic, and then as I was doing the intro, I just thought, I'll just ask Gary. I don't even need to say it. So we're going to Argentina. Obviously, quick recap on episode 1, Gary, because like we say, this is a new series. And we were in Asunción, and it was just the wacky races of Paraguayan football. were you pleased and happy with how it went?
Oh, delighted. I mean, you know, talk about when we sort of started, and the Asunción, I put it in first because I wasn't sure how it would go. And it's, I mean, personally, I didn't know a lot about Paraguayan football. I don't know a lot now, but I know a lot more after listening to Pete. But, you know, the conversation I thought would probably last 40, 45 minutes. I think we went on for about 75, 85 minutes or so. So, you know, when you've got a guy like Pete on, all the knowledge comes out, the discussion just follows great. So, yeah, it was a fantastic opening episode. And although some of the clubs were probably lesser known, that's not the case today. There's some real Goliath clubs in Avellaneda.
Well, you just keep saying it. It's just not sinking in. We're going to be all over if I have to say it tonight.
You'll be fine.
Stephen, obviously, welcome. Again, like we say, it was your good self that likened it to a Hanna-Barbera cartoon. Who knows what we'll end up with in this episode, but a good start to a new series.
Oh, great start. Great series, great start. And massively looking forward to this one too. You know, some, you know, iconic clubs. You know, I think, you know, arguably, you know, the most iconic South American club here. As part of this, you know, no team has won more Copa Libertadores as one of our teams tonight. So, you know, how would you get much more iconic than that in terms of being South American team?
And like I say, I think we both have an almost subversive want for these stories to have, like as you said, a bit of Dick Dastardly about them. We want that little bit of subterfuge. We want that little bit of sort of underhand sleight of hand stories.
We do indeed. Yes, you know, I think less wacky races tonight, I think, though, because, you know, it comes down to, although there are more cast members, you know, it comes down to a defined rivalry between two, you know, massive clubs, really. So this I think this one leans more towards the Warner Brothers. And there's a bit of Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote to this one.
Well, brilliant.
I will find a cartoon connotation for every single episode of this, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm loving that. Yeah, I'm all over the cartoons as a kid. And then obviously, fresh from the Acme factory himself, then I guess, we've got, we have Pete, who, let's face it, this would be one, an incredibly short episode and really quite a dull series if we didn't have Pete with us. So, Pete, obviously, well, thank God you're here, really, more than anything else. And thank you for joining us. And like Gary said, I'm sure you're going to more than comfortably fill the allotted time tonight.
Oh, it's always good to be chatting about South American football. And, it's assorted kind of nefarious dealings and evil doings and escapades and stuff like that. You know, it's certainly quite cartoonish at times, so. I'm just fearing for when we get to Colombia, how kind of Stevie's going to kind of pick a good description for some of the Medellin teams. That's going to be an interesting one in particular. So,
I'll find a way.
I was going to say, yeah, he's got a bit of time, but he'll definitely find a way.
I'll find a way.
okay, Pete. So, to kick us off, then, As Stephen mentioned, you know, in this club, it's very much in this city, sorry, it's very much a duopoly of clubs. But as we saw in episode one, there are also, and I'm assuming this is still the case, my first bit of ignorance of the evening, but that, you know, there are other clubs within this city and certainly within the geography of the city. So if you can just give us, you know, give us a bit of information about these two main clubs, but also about football within the city.
Yeah. So the first thing that's worth saying about Llaneda is that it feels a little bit like it's part of Buenos Aires. If you were to look on a map, you wouldn't think it was a distinct city. But actually, it is a very separate place. It has its own distinct identity. It's separated from what is considered to be the city of Buenos Aires by the Riachuelo, a river. There's a few bridges that go across. So Avellaneda, even though it's kind of part of, I suppose, greater Buenos Aires, it still is a very distinct city with its own distinct identity. And the two clubs that we're going to talk about mostly tonight, presumably, are very much a crucial part of Avellaneda and what makes it different from being Buenos Aires. You know, Buenos Aires is seen as being a bit more arrogant, a little bit more, I suppose, metropolitan, cosmopolitan, whereas Avellaneda is a little bit more working class, a little bit more true to its roots, a little bit more humble origins. And in many ways, the two clubs kind of symbolise that. So the two clubs particularly that we're going to be talking about are two of the big five. We've got Racing Club and we've got Club Atlético Independiente, or always just known as Independiente. They're historically two of the biggest five in Argentina, joined by San Lorenzo, Boca Juniors and River Plate. And their origins are from the first 5 years of the 20th century, which is a really productive time for Argentinian football. You see a lot of clubs developing. But as you said, they're not the only two. There are some kind of smaller clubs that have come and gone. A lot of these clubs start with origins in social clubs that start in neighbourhoods and barrios and are linked to different businesses or different factories. The Avellaneda area was very known as for being near the port, for meatpacking, for kind of furs, and a lot of the kind of businesses that were making Buenos Aires boom at that particular time. And again, some of the other clubs that were there around about the start, and some of them have died away, some of them have maintained. There was a club called Club Progresista, which actually produced a couple of, you know, the great legends of Avellaneda and Buenos Aires football and Argentinian football, particularly Antonio Sastre, Manuel Seoane, were both players at Progresista before that club eventually disappeared in the 30s. Another club that actually has won the Argentinian League is a club called Sportivo Dock Sud, who were originally founded in 1914, dissolved. Actually, then they kind of set up a club called Follow Me If You Can, Sigame Si Puede, which was a kind of great name for a club trying to get people from the neighbourhood supporting this club that had started and fallen apart. And they managed to get going again. And even, you know, and like we said, they won an Argentinian league, although it was at a time where there was a kind of a schism between the two Argentinian leagues. A lot of the bigger clubs were in the other one, but Club Sportivo Dock Sud did win the division that they were in. So they're still down as being one of the champions of the first division in Argentina. And probably the other main club, I suppose, that really is in the city of Avellaneda, more or less, are a club called San Telmo, who have mostly been around about the Primera B, the second division or the third division. They did make it into the first division in 1976 and even beat Boca Juniors, which is one of the great dates of their history. I suppose the one other club that people might know about that probably we can count as being in or linked to Avellaneda is Arsenal de Sarandí. Sarandí is in what you'd call the Avellaneda municipality. It's kind of part of the administrative district. It's not really in the city itself. It's seen as being separate, although again it's part of the sprawling metropolis that Buenos Aires is. Arsenal Sarandí were actually founded very late, in I think it was the 1950s. Julio Grondona, one of the most controversial and powerful figures in Argentine football history, responsible for their particular foundation. And they were a club that struggled to really create much of an impact until they finally got into just after the turn of the century and have done pretty well since. So, but the two main clubs, without any doubt, are Racing and Independiente.
I guess we'll come to you, Gary, and obviously you know, straight away there's first period over with. That's the first part of the lesson for today. And I think the and what's going to play out, I think, in this series is that there's this assumption, or certainly for myself, and there'll be people far better educated than me on this, but this assumption of the big clubs, the well-known clubs in the areas, in the cities that we're going into. But it's the stories about the other clubs and, you know, and players that have maybe come from less well-known clubs that help to really sort of drive the narrative of this series.
Yeah, I guess so. And Pete mentioned Antonio Sastro, who was at Progressista and the other team before he moved on. And there was a couple of guys play international football for Argentina. Carlos Lauretta and Juan Bianchi, the only two players in the history of the club who played international football. You know, names that you sort of probably don't know about, but must have been massively important to the club at the time. And, you know, it's great to hear Pete say about Atletico San Telmo, because another team that I found when I was doing a little research, and the fact that they got to the top level and turned Boca over, and that must have been a fantastic achievement for a club of that size. So yeah, there's always lots of nice stories, you know, below the headlines as well. And you know, the headlines in this in Avellaneda, they're, you know, Racing and Independiente, they're proper big beasts.
They are clubs that listeners will probably most readily identify. But and again, coming to you, Stephen, I suppose it's a little bit more about the geography, and that's how, you know, as Pete said earlier, you know, the proximity to Buenos Aires, but to me, and again, this is probably my naivety, but certainly South America seems very patriotic, probably isn't the right word, but very proud of where they're from. And, you know, even when they're sort of close to a huge sprawling metropolis like Buenos Aires, they still manage to retain that independent identity and almost that refusal to be swamped by the sort of the bigger cities. And I guess that's probably something that football allows most geographical locations to do. You know, you have to think about it in this country, in Europe, you know, and football is one of those sort of social tools that allows cities, towns to maintain that independence and sort of have an identity away from the ever-increasing sprawl of urban areas.
Yeah, it's that sense of being proudly tribal, I think. You know, it's, you know, your chance, like you say, it is down to, you know, identity. You know, you have this, I don't know, people will work, they'll study, whatever it is, whatever their day-to-day life is. And then, you know, there you've got this place to go and congregate, and human nature is just floods through football in that respect, because, you know, throughout the centuries, people have congregated for one reason or another, or one cause or another, whether that's, you know, religion or, you know, any other multitude of reasons to do so, wars, battles, you know, just survival as such. You know, it's a human nature to pull together with, you know, a set of comrades that, you know, support your cause. And football is just a microcosm of that. And yes, you know, I think for a place like Avellaneda, I say I'm struggling with it now. I'm sympathy struggles for Stu now.
Avellaneda.
Avellaneda. So to be so close in proximity to Buenos Aires, it is, you know, probably even more brought into focus, I think. You know, this is very different to kind of, you know, two distinct major cities that are within close proximity. You know, this is one that's kind of under the umbrella of another. The only experience I've had of that, because obviously the UK is very different in that respect, is when I went to Japan and how Yokohama is within the broader spectrum of Tokyo as such. But it's very, very much its own city. It's got very, very much its own identity. You know, it ended up hosting the World Cup final, you know, and you know, so yes, you know, I've experienced that type of situation, that type of environment. And, you know, I experienced how proud people from Yokohama were of being from Yokohama. And, you know, whatever you do, don't kind of like, you know, bracket them in with Tokyo. They are themselves. And in a way, it, you know, these type of cities and areas, probably more tribal and more partisan than maybe two big cities like, say, Liverpool and Manchester, you know, who can be massively tribal. Yet, you know, they are very much their own cities, no matter how close they are together. There is no overlap as such.
First of all, Stephen, thank you for mispronouncing the name. You didn't need to do that for me, but I am incredibly grateful.
I'll not say I did it on purpose, Jim.
I thought you'd literally done me a favour. Bearing that in mind, Pete, and obviously when we talked about Asuncion, I'll tell you what, by the time we get to the end of this series, there's going to be so many mispronunciations as I go back through the episodes. But anyway, so in episode one, Asuncion, and we talked about teams who do well in the Copa Libertadores and this sort of discussion about whether or not, you know, other Paraguay supporters or supporters of teams from Asuncion, would they support a rival team yet in a continental competition? And this question is a little bit similar to this, I guess. And obviously, teams in Avellaneda, there's my attempt at it. So teams there, are they, again, fiercely protected? So Racing and Independiente, do they sort of almost look after each other in terms of being away from Buenos Aires and the big clubs in there? Or again, do we still have this, I know what Gary's going to say, which is why I'm asking you, Pete. But, you know, are they very much, no, we're two clubs and we're from this city, we're not part of Buenos Aires, or do they just see themselves as fiercely independent entities?
I mean, they are not going to support each other when the other team is in the Libertadores, let's say that to start with. There is a huge amount of pride and competition about being the representatives of Avellaneda. Similarly, you know, the rivalries with the clubs in Buenos Aires are very intense. You know, they are from a long way back. You know, I think that if you look at the kind of rivalries that existed within clubs from Avellaneda and Buenos Aires, there have been kind of frictions and fights and disturbances, you know, both on and off the pitch. You know, it is kind of Latin American, you know, football and tempers get heated. But, you know, there are a lot of stories of violence between these clubs that go back really into the 1920s. So, you know, although there will be pride in some sense of an Argentinian team representing, you know, the country, particularly if it might be against a national enemy, for example, England, potentially Brazil, you know, there is still not going to be any pleasure should, you know, Racing, for example, become the first team to win the Intercontinental Cup. You know, that is one in the eye for Independiente, who had been winning the Libertadores as the first Argentinian club to do that. So I think these identities are very different. And I think that, I mean, going on from what Stevie was saying a little bit about the identities, I mean, Avellaneda, there's actually a film called Moon of Avellaneda, Luna de Avellaneda, which really sums up this idea of a place which has very, very localized important identities. And these are kind of based from the time where a lot of these people were coming from abroad, from Italy, from Spain, you know, potentially from Germany, from the interior of Argentina, looking for jobs and finding a kind of place within, you know, certain areas of the poorer districts, which Avellaneda was. It was a very industrial district. And the kind of social clubs that were created there were the kind of the, you know, the heart of the street, of the neighborhood, of the factory. And I mean, Club Sportivo Sud, Sportivo Dock Sud are a perfect example of that. You know, it is a social club. This is where people go. This is where people are members. The families are members. The, you know, the wives are there. The kids are there. It's there are places where they play football. They play other sports, and then they come together. And they eat and they drink. They listen to tango, and kind of stories are woven around these things. And because of this very traceable hub of identity and of culture, you know, they do preserve that, and it is very distinct. And, you know, the amount of videos you watch of, you know, there are quite a few documentaries, you know, in the 100-year anniversary of Racing and Independiente. And they talk about it being something that is passed down from father from father to son. It's in the blood. It's like a transfusion. So, you know, it is very important. It is very distinct. You know, there are a lot of rivalries that have created over history, you know, that kind of footballing separation. That means that, you know, a club identity will take, and a club pride and loyalty will take precedence over a national one. Should, you know, another team from Buenos Aires be competing in an international competition, ostensibly representing the country, you know, that I think that's more or less as well as I can describe it.
No, that's fine. That's a great answer to my question. Does that reassure you, Gary?
Yeah.
I thought it would.
I'm always reassured when Dr. Pete talks. I'm always reassured.
And I suppose as well that, you know, that as well, Gary, that notion of the sporting club that Pete was just talking about there, it's something that fascinates me, and certainly something that, you know, I'd noticed on, you know, when you do the sort of, you know, we'd done junior football trips to the Netherlands or to Germany, and there's this culture of the sporting club being this hub of the community, like Pete said, but yet here it's football seems to almost isolate itself from other sports and almost not want to be, you know, I mean, I can think of my little boy who's played for a team called South Cave, you know, and it, there was a golf club there and it had a cricket club, but the football club kept itself so separate from everything else that went on. Whereas, you know, other experiences that I've had, like say on the continent, it's been fully embraced, and it, you know, and every, it is like almost the centre of the community.
Yeah, I mean, I think Pete can sort of tell me I'm wrong here, but I think these clubs we mentioned here are multi-sport clubs. Mm. They do have lots of different clubs, different activities going on there, and it's, I mean, I'm not sure whether it comes from Spain because of the Spanish heritage, because it's very similar sort of thing over here. So you get clubs like Real Madrid, they have basketball teams, they have ice hockey teams, they have handball teams. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's perhaps a case in that may have been sort of imported from the Spanish sort of culture here. But there's another thing as well, which is interesting, when Pete mentioned about the identity they feel here. And there's a thing in Spain where the pueblo, the town where people come, is very important. The identity is there. And I sort of saw echoes in what Pete was describing. I don't know if that's accurate, but it sounded very similar to the sort of, you know, in England, it's perhaps not so much. You might live in London, but you might support Liverpool. You might live in Newcastle. You might support Man City. You might live in Bristol and support Tottenham, you know. But that's not so much the case in Spain. The local identity is a really important. I mean, it's not always the case. But for example, in the town where I'm here, there's a Peña, a sports club, or athletic club from up in the Basque Country. But that's unusual. Even the smaller clubs, the less successful clubs, have a strong hold on the local community. It's a real hub for them.
It's a great point, and I suppose I was going to ask you, Stephen, because as Gary mentioned there, and the first club that popped into my head was Barcelona and the basketball team, the handball team. You know, there is a multitude of sports that run out of Barcelona, but yet you don't find this at Liverpool, at Manchester United, at Tottenham. You know, like I say, and I suppose it's not which came first, but you know, but does it not happen at a lower level because the elite level clubs do it, or did it never take off at elite level because grassroots and communities never did it?
Yes, I think certainly from a UK perspective, you know, football was very much hijacked by the working classes. You know, it was drawn up, all the rules were drawn up on the hallowed turfs of public schools, and you know, the rules were set and gentlemen played, but then the working classes took it over, and essentially the working classes were playing football. They weren't playing polo, they weren't playing, you know, croquet, you know, they weren't playing these other sports. So, you know, you've got to look at when these teams materialised. You've got to look at, you know, the environments that these teams are rooted in. So, yes, you know, from a British perspective, it's just something that completely jars. You know, I think a lot of people look at a football club, whether that's Liverpool, Everton, Manchester United, Man City, you know, across so many big cities in the UK, is that, you know, you're unlikely to find that crossing the streams. And it's not just a football thing. You don't really tend to see rugby clubs branching out into other sports as well. There are very much, defined partitions are put up. There are divides between the sports, which, you know, as Gary says, it's certainly not the way in Spain. You know, very, very kind of like, you know, acclimatized and attuned to the fact that, you know, many of them run basketball clubs. I mean, I've known that for many, many years. I mean, I can remember watching some of these games in the early days of satellite television with kind of like German commentaries and being kind of like amazed by the fact that Barcelona were playing, you know, a basketball team. So, yeah, but yeah, I it does make sense, you know, but at the same time, you know, conditioning and, you know, centuries worth of I don't know, so it's just kind of like conditioning, really. You know, it's all it comes down to.
We will get back on script here. I am really sorry, but I do find this quite interesting. Do South America, does South America, Argentina, whatever, do they look at England or the UK and question and do what I'm doing and question it the other way around as to why does the UK not integrate itself more through multi-sports clubs? You know, why is football so isolated? Or like Stephen said as well about rugby doesn't involve itself, but, you know, everything's so separate over here. Do South Americans question why we're the opposite?
Yeah, I don't know if they question why it's like that. I think that, you know, because I think in lots of ways, you know, the sporting structures in Britain were already there. And I think that in lots of ways, they don't question why it was different. They just say, why are we different to what happened elsewhere? Or why were they different to us? There is that kind of difference. I think that one of the things that tends to maybe surprise some of the South Americans I've spoke to. I mean, I did a kind of talk with some Barra members, some kind of fan group members of Atlético Nacional in Colombia, and they were asked that, you know, one of the questions was, can you tell us about football and its structures and you know how deep it is in society. And one of the things I said that for me the biggest difference was that football in Britain is not linked to certain just two or three cities. It goes very, very deep, and every club is pretty much linked to a town or city. That's one of the major differences. Obviously, you've got London, which is a little bit different, and some of the other major cities, you know, you've got maybe two or three clubs. But there's a striking difference in, for example, you know, Buenos Aires or Asunción compared to, you know, really big cities in Britain, which only have two clubs, for example. I think the case in the South American context is that they start really as social clubs. You know, I think it's really important to see that they're not a sporting club. It might be sport focused, but there's a lot of focus on being a club of members who come together in a smaller area, and that's where it starts. And then they do pretty well, you know, due to, you know, a lot of people being in that particular area and all being involved in the social club's activities. And so it starts from those kind of origins with lots of separate clubs starting up rather than one or two in a city that come to symbolise the whole city. And again, so I think you're right, you know, when they start, they have tennis, they might have rugby potentially in Argentina, slightly less so in Avellaneda, which is more of a working class they'd start with. Some of the bigger teams in Buenos Aires Central, you know, will have rugby and some will have cricket as well because they're more elite based. But that's what they start. They start with lots of multiple activities for their members because the playing of sports and the doing of different activities is seen as being important for the society. And that might be the factory as well. The factory might be sponsoring lots of different activities for their workers to do. And it won't just be sport. There'll be a lot of cultural evenings, you know, like, I mean, for example, tango is very much associated with a lot of the football. And Racing particularly claim ownership of the greatest figure in Argentinian tango, Carlos Gardel, you know, he was you know, supposedly a fan of Racing. He was a great friend of the captain of the great Racing team of the 1910s. So you've got all kinds of different linkages. It's much more, it starts as being a social area with lots of different activities that go on for the whole membership. It's not, we have a football team and we have a supporters club around it. It is, this is the social club with as many things as our members, you know, and we put on as many things as we can for the members of the club. And I think that that's where a lot of this importance of the local identity also fuses in, because it welcomes in everyone in that community. So the footballers are playing, but then they're going to work, you know, in the factory, in the bakery, on the docks, and then they'll be sitting and having a beer with their mates in the club, and sitting alongside tango singers, and it all kind of meshes together and kind of unites this kind of neighbourhood or this barrio around a social club. And then it just happens to be the football club is the one that gets the most currency, because that one gets the most popularity, gets the most reporting, and then starts to kind of represent, you know, the neighbourhood well, and then obviously the city, and then the nation. So it kind of builds up from there, I think, from very kind of closely knit activities, I suppose.
I've just add to that is that, you know, within that club, Progresista were a great example of that. You know, a football club of purpose in the 1920s, and they kind of stopped playing about 15 years later. You know, within that, as a social aspect, they kind of still exist, but they've not played football for about 80 or 90 years. They continue to play other sports. You know, so this is, you know, a concept that still lives today. They just stopped playing football.
It's interesting. Well, a lot of the clubs aren't called Club de Football. They're called Deportivo or Sporting Club de, because that's more descriptive of the comprehensive activities that they offer to the community.
I mean, the Sportivo Docks are a perfect example. I mean, the fact they were called Sígame Sin Puede, follow me if you can, you know, when they look like going out of business. And the whole idea of saying, follow me if you can, let's get together. And, you know, you look at, you know, they're kind of existing kind of fan pages talk a lot about being socios, about being members, about the club and what's going on. You know, there's lots of good stories about that club in the early days where, you know, they managed to get a free pot of land that was granted to them by the, you know, the dock kind of company that was there. But then they had to flatten the pitch, they had to build facilities, you know, and it was the people of the neighbourhood would go after work on this plot of land, work to build the changing rooms, you know, and that's how they did it, you know, and there are lots of stories like that. And I suppose that it's, I mean, there's lots of interesting stories about, it just tends to be the clubs that did it best grew. You know, I mean, Independiente start from being a group of guys who worked in a department store who didn't want to, who weren't playing for that particular club that was organised from there. So then they set up their own one called Independiente. And it just really happened that they just worked it better. And then they got to the point where, you know, they built their own facilities, they got their own ground, and then it grew. I mean, Alumni, for example, who are a major club in Buenos Aires, and before, you know, Racing really take off, the reason they go out of business is that they weren't founded around a social club. They were kind of friends from a school, but they never established a hub. They didn't really have a ground, a clubhouse, a social point of contact, and they would just kind of play here and there, and then they eventually kind of slip out of existence. Whereas Racing, Independiente, and all these other clubs who do come from a strong social background, you know, eventually will, you know, through their membership, through the support, through finding good players, whatever else, manage to grow and, you know, become the forces that they eventually did.
A couple of very contrasting examples of that. I mean, many people will know, but Barcelona is owned by the fans, is owned by the socios. There's no Russian oligarch or American consortium or Middle East or magnates there. It's owned by the fans. And I'm a local club here, Club Deportivo Torrevieja. They went out of business last year. And basically, there's been another club formed, and it's called Sporting Costa Blanca. Now, Sporting Costa Blanca, it sounds to me anything except Spanish. And that's because that's what it is. It's basically a club that's been sort of, not designed for tourists, but designed for not necessarily produced by the local people. And I think the success and failure of that club will be very reflective of what Pete's just described.
It's a concept that fascinates me. It always has fascinated me. And I think it's a wonderful concept. You know, I love the idea of a social club. I love the idea of teams forming out of the social club and activities, you know, almost being decided upon by the sort of the wants of the members. But I appreciate we've digressed a little bit, but it is relevant because Pete says it is. So that's good enough for me. Obviously, the two clubs that, you know, like you said, you know, Racing and Independiente, the two clubs we're probably going to talk about the most. In terms of those two clubs, you know, with regards to who it represents, you know, you've mentioned already that Avellaneda is a very working class city. But in terms of the two clubs, is there any other social differential that sort of separates these two sides?
Probably not really. I think that certain linkages became important at different times, which established certain points of diverse identity. Racing become really important because I think in lots of ways, Racing somehow feel like the most Argentinian of clubs. You know, they almost represent Argentina in lots of ways. The reason for that is that they are, without doubt, the first proper Argentinian football team. You know, that prior to them, all the leagues that were there had been won by sides of, you know, British-related teams. You know, whether this is Alumni or Lomas, there are a lot of, you know, more elite-linked teams. They're students of former schools. There are a lot of British names in the teams that are winning the league. Racing, you know, dominate the 1910s. They win, you know, something like 7 out of 8 or 8 out of 9, I can't quite remember what the figures are in that period. But the most important thing about them is that they are an Argentinian team. They're a criollo team. They're a team of Argentinians who are recognised as being different from the English. And it's the moment, Racing are the club which make football Argentinian, which shows that they can compete against, you know, well, they can be better than the people who taught them football, you know, who brought them football. There's kind of like a second period, I suppose, where Racing become very Argentinian, and that's really in the Perón years. I suppose actually even before that, you know, thinking back to Argentina, Racing also take on blue and white. You know, their kit is very similar to the national kit. And that was in honour of the 100th anniversary of the May Revolution. So again, they tied themselves to very important Argentinian symbols. In the 1950s, or at the end of the 1940s, 50s, not due to Perón necessarily, but due to his finance minister, a guy called Ramón Cerejo, who was a really ardent Racing fan. Perón's government sponsors the building of El Cilindro, the stadium of Racing. And they put a lot of money into that. They get a very favourable interest rate, you know. And that also kind of tied them to, because the stadium is named after Perón as well, Perón and Evita are both given honorary memberships. So Racing again become tied to someone who has talked about how important sport is to the nation, how important, you know, Racing become quite important to the nation in this kind of way as well. Independiente are slightly different, I think, in that, if anything, because of the rivalry with Racing, they're slightly less likely to be Peronistas. The kind of the Peronista fan, you know, Peronista party is fairly continuous still. There is slightly less likelihood of being that. But in lots of ways, I don't think it's very easy to say, oh, Racing are this and Independiente are that. I don't think you can really look at origins or political creed necessarily as being very different. I think that, you know, it starts on locality. It starts on being who your dad supported, who your brother, who your uncle supported, whoever took you to that first game. But a lot of them will come from, you know, Avellaneda, but also from a lot of the poorer areas of the Buenos Aires metropolitan area as well, you know. So I think that's where the identities lie. Racing do have a very, very strong Argentine identity because of what they achieved when it really mattered for Argentina, you know, when it was important for sport was being used as being a tool for national integration or a tool for national pride or a tool for national prominence. Racing were the first team that really did that. So, yeah, there isn't a way of telling who will be an Independiente fan there.
I'll tell you what, Pete, you've thrown up a brilliant question that I'm going to ask Gary and Stephen. Okay, guys, I was going to ask you about England, but I'm not. I'm going to throw it worldwide. Can you name me, or in your opinion, another club that best represents its nation? So as Pete said there, Racing is the most Argentine of football clubs. I can see you looking away, Gary. You can't avoid the question. So if you cast your mind across the globe, can you come up with another equivalent of a club that best represents the country that it sits in? Because I think that's a great point to make, and it's something that I've never really thought of. And it's Pete's question, but I just get to ask it. So I'll ask you first, Gary.
I guess, yeah, I mean, I think the obvious one is Real Madrid. You'd probably go with Real Madrid first off. Perhaps Bayern Munich to some extent, although Bayern Munich are particularly Bavarian. I mean, the Germans are overwhelmingly Bavarian as well. Italy is very difficult. There's lots of sort of, I mean, there wouldn't be an obvious one in Italy, I can think of. PSG in France, but they're sort of a nouveau club, aren't they? So I'm not sure they're the right to be sort of representative of the country. I mean, the obvious one that I say is, I mean, and I guess if I was sitting in, if I'm sitting in Spain, I am sitting in Spain, which is a stupid thing to say. If I was sitting in another country, I mean, if I was not English, I'd perhaps say Manchester United in England, because their reputation, perhaps suggests that. But, you know, I think the obvious one is Real Madrid. I'm interested in the other guys say, though.
Well, there we go, Stephen. You now have the rest of them to pick from.
I mean, every football club has got to be polarising in some form or another. I mean, Bayern Munich as an instance. I mean, I remember working with a German fella around, it was when they played Man United in the Champions League final. And I can remember discussion the day of the game, and someone had said, oh, so you're supporting Bayern Munich tonight, aren't you? And he was like, no. He said, you're either for them or against them. And we laughed and said, well, it's very much a similar thing for Manchester United. Within Spain, you know, Real Madrid, you know, massively popular across the board, yet also, you know, the enemy to so many, you know, especially around the, you know, I'm sure if you ask, you know, the popularity of Real Madrid up in the Basque region, you might get a very different answer, for instance, or Catalonia. You know, you're looking at clubs being universally popular, you know, even if you were to turn around and say like an Ajax, you know, Ajax rub a lot of people wrong in their own nation. Juventus are very, very popular across the breadth of Italy. You know, they were notorious for the fact that they were more popular outside of Turin than they were within Turin. You know, they would have very low attendances at the Stadio Comunale. But, you know, thousands, if not millions of supporters across the breadth of the country. You know, other examples, maybe someone like a Benfica, who meant so much to Portugal in the days when they were winning the European Cup, and Eusebio being such a superstar. Yes, you know, there are instances here and there, but within that, you know, every club is polarising to someone.
I just thought of a couple of things. Bayern is a really interesting one. Just seeing what Stevie says. When I was doing my research in my book on Chelsea in the Champions League 2012, I was talking to Olli Hesse, the German author and journalist, who is top blog, and he was saying that in Germany, you are a Bayern fan, or you don't like Bayern, there's no middle ground, and there's overwhelmingly they're not liked. But another one who would represent the country would be Dynamo Kiev, I think would be a good one.
I was going to say that, I mean, I think that Racing, you know, people in Argentina will not say Racing is the team that represents Argentina. You know, Boca, River Plate, Independiente definitely won't. I think that what's interesting is that Racing was so significant in terms of their symbology and in terms of what the triumphs that they had when it really mattered were a key reason why it took off. They were very responsible for it because they were so dominant. I mean, going back to Stu's question, which is a great question, I think that it's always something that if you are not from that country, you will probably think of one club when you think of that country. I think it, like Stevie said, you know, as well, and Gary, you know, football polarizes within. I was wondering whether in clubs that something like Santos during the Pelé years might have become very close, that about as close as you can in Brazil, because they went on almost a diplomatic tours around the world, as you know, and Pelé was such a pride for the nation, that whether that kind of transcended, you know, the Paulista, you know, rivalries within Sao Paulo, and obviously the rivalries with Rio, you know, whether that's close. I mean, Flamengo are obviously the most supported club in Brazil, but I wonder if that Santos team came close. The other examples, I guess, you have, you know, they are something like the Steaua Bucharest team of Romania, or maybe some of those really big, you know, when the communist regimes are going, the really big army club, you know, whether that, you know, all the kind of players are kind of funneled towards those army clubs. I don't know. That's probably the other, you know, the teams that I can think of that might come close to it.
Thanks, guys. It was, like I say, it was a great point that was made. And then obviously from there come just things that I would like to know. In terms of the two clubs then, you know, Pete, obviously, you know, like you said, there's sort of two of the big five, but, you know, and you mentioned sort of Copa Libertadores success in that beginning part. But just as a, I suppose, to put into context for ourselves and for the listeners, you know, where do they stand within the context of Argentine football as national champions, national cup winners, you know, continental winners?
Yeah. So domestically, they're very successful. Racing have won the league 18 times. Independiente just behind them with 16. They've won various kind of cup competitions as well. I think that it's possible to argue that their power has not been huge in recent years in terms of success. I think that's fair. If you look at Racing, most of their titles, well, I mean, they've won from 1913 through to 1921, apart from in 1920. They had a great run then. You know, that was certainly one of the great Racing sides, with people like Alberto Arco, one of the great kind of figures of early Argentine football. Independiente have a period of strength in the 1938 and 1939. There's a brilliant Independiente team which you know, which is where the Diablos Rojos kind of nickname comes from. Actually, there's a great team in the late 20s as well. The 1930s team with Sastre, with Arsenio Arica, the great Paraguayan we mentioned last week as well, Vicente del Mata, are a phenomenon. They score a ridiculous amount of goals. I think they score 115 goals in 20 odd matches or something ridiculous in one particular season. Racing again have a period of success at the end of the 1949-50-51. I think they're the only team in Argentina to win it 3 years in a row. Independiente, though, you know, become, you know, one of their nicknames is the King of Cups, the Rey de Copas. And that's because they really dominate domestic football, not so much, but certainly continental football. You know, they win the Libertadores 4 years in a row from 72 to 75. It's really unheard of. They'd already won it twice before that in 64 and 65. You know, and this really established themselves as, you know, arguably the dominant team in certainly South American football. You could argue one of the great teams in world football, although they struggled in some of the intercontinental cups. You know, they lost their first few games when they got to that final. But again, really since, I suppose, the 1990s, Independiente have only won two titles. Racing, you know, got relegated, won absolutely nothing in the 70s and 80s. We might come to a nice story about that later on. But they've done a little bit better since then. They've won in 2014, 2018. But, you know, they're slightly, you know, their kind of trophy-winning success has kind of declined in the most recent years. And, you know, this century, they've struggled compared to, you know, River, Boca, and even some smaller clubs. You know, you look at someone like Godoy Cruz, who are a very unheralded team, have come in the top three of the Primera División more than Independiente have in the last 15 years, for example. So, you know, they're not quite the powerhouse they used to be, but the certainly the fan support is still as fanatical as it always ever was.
I mean, you know, coming to you, Gary, you know, obviously we're all football fans here. And I guess, you know, and I keep going back to it, but as Pete sort of mentioned, this sort of big five in Argentine football. But for the good of the foot, and other team supporters won't agree with this, and that I am aware of, but for the good of Argentine football, you want your, you know, if it's a big five, it's a big seven, whatever that number is, you want them all to be competitive in order to, I suppose, propel the quality to, you know, to improve everybody else. You almost need your rival to push you to be better as well.
Yeah, I think this is something that sort of, I would say, doesn't apply so much in England. It does, but it's much more liquid in England. So, you know, the big five in England 10 years ago, Man City wouldn't have been there. You know, before Roman Abramovich, Chelsea wouldn't have been there. Liverpool hadn't won the title for 30 years. You know, so that, it's been more liquid. But in Argentina, when Pete mentioned the big five, it's a fairly consistent big five, or considered so to be anyway. But it's interesting, Pete mentioned about the tough time Racing had had since the turn of the century. And I did a little bit of research on this, and since 2000, they have had no, bear in mind we're now in 2021, so we're just over 20 years, they've had no less than 37 different coaches. I mean, you know, talk about, you know, Chelsea turnover of managers. I mean, that's pretty rapid. And I mean, I'm not the Racing, but that's pretty quick turnover. But, you know, so you know, the sort of struggle they've had has sort of been reflected in the turnover coaches. And, you know, as Pete mentioned, they won the title in 2018, the first one for a long time. But with Independiente being the Cup Kings, I think they have won the title for about the best part of 20 years. I think just after the turn of the century, I think, when I looked at it this morning. So here's, you know, two clubs who sort of had a fairly fallow period since the turn of the century. Or just afterwards, they still maintain their high status as part of the big five, which is how I was sort of trying to sort of compare that to the big five, big six, big seven, whatever you want to call it, in England is a bit more liquid.
I suppose, and I guess this is a slightly different question, although it's, you know, it is something that Pete sort of mentioned, and that's the importance that South American club sides taking that Intercontinental Cup fixture, if you like, although obviously FIFA like to change things around a little bit now. But, you know, when it was South America, you know, the champions of South America versus the champions of Europe, you know, that game was so important to South American side.
Oh, massively. You know, even certain European nations took it hugely. It's always been very popular in Italy. You know, the Italian clubs have always taken it deathly seriously. You know, it's you know, the English tend to have this, you know, a habitual suspicion of anything new and anything different. You know, they are creatures of habit, is what they are. You know, you only have to look at how long it took them to rejoin FIFA, how long it took them to take part in a World Cup. You know, they met the inception of the European Cup with pitchforks and flaming torches and told Chelsea not to take part. You know, it is a European Championship. You know, they don't take part properly until 68. You know, it's only a token effort in 64. Don't take part at all in 60. And they're not alone in that. You know, other nations have told that kind of line. You know, not just British nations, UK nations. But yes, you know, South America take this massively seriously. You know, as far as they're concerned, they are playing to be the champions of the world, the best team on the face of the planet. You know, it's the ultimate bragging right. It's the ultimate thing from their perspective to be able to do. You know, as a Liverpool supporter, what are we talking about now? 18 months or so ago, 16 months or so ago, you know, beating Flamengo in Qatar, you know, we turn around and shrug our shoulders a little and say, how nice. You know, who do we play next in the league? You know, when's the Champions League draw? You know, that it's that kind of focus. We tend to see them as trinkets, these prizes, a World Club Cup, a European Super Cup, a Charity Shield, still will not call it the Community Shield. You know, they're all kind of like trinkets as far as certain sports. Are concerned in this country, because the biggest prizes are the league title and the European Cup. But But for South America, no, it's very, very different. You know, the Libertadores is massive, but then even beyond that, the Intercontinental Cup was everything. I mean, to look at, say, when Liverpool played Flamengo in 81, you know, they went well beforehand. You know, they were there a good week or so before the game took place. You know, three or four days before Liverpool were playing that match, they were taking on Arsenal in a 120-minute League Cup game. You know, it's the whole vision of it. You know, it jars somewhat. The two sides of that, it's changed a bit. I think the European sides, you know, take to it, you know, a little bit more readily now. You know, they see it for what it is. It's a chance to be able to call yourself world champions. You know, and I think, you know, that balance has not evened out, but it is at least a little bit more, you know, an olive branch almost being stretched out. But yeah, the South Americans, you know, I don't know, maybe now, I don't know, even more so because they don't win it quite so often anymore. You know, because of that exodus of so many of the greatest South American players have gone very, very soon in their career. You know, I'll hark back to that 81 game against Flamengo and Zico and Junior being in there. If that was now, those players would have been in Europe 10 years prior to this match. You know, but yes, the Intercontinental Cup was absolutely massive for South American teams.
I mean, I suppose that's a whole other discussion, P, and you know, and probably something that we should get into at some point, guys. Not that I'm trying to create a new series for us or anything, but I think I certainly think that might. I'm just ticking away something in my brain while you were chatting there, Stephen, about an idea. However, back to this podcast, obviously. And, you know, you mentioned there, Pete, about the sort of fluctuations of the club. You know, you only had to mention, like, you know, two different, leading by two in terms of league title victories. So, you know, there's certainly an evenness, but as, you know, as we all know on here, you know, football is, you know, comes in waves, success comes in waves. You know, and at the moment, it's very fallow period for both of them. But as an Argentine, sort of not living in Avellaneda, you know, who is perceived as the more dominant club of the two?
Oh, I would suspect that Independiente would be seen as the more dominant club, particularly because Racing can point to a lot more trophies in the amateur era. You know, Racing, you know, seven of their titles come in the 1910s. So they're kind of amateur. It's a period where football is not very professional. Yes, it was important. But, you know, I think that in terms of the collective memory, the, you know, the successes of the Independiente team who are dominating South America in the, you know, in the early years of the Copa Libertadores and certainly 1970s. And the kind of players that are appearing in that team, you know, I mean, particularly Boccini, the kind of legend of Independiente, you know, that they would probably be seen as the more dominant club because they've done that. I think also you have a period where Racing just are a disaster, you know, and we might as well talk about it now. I mean, you know, going back to the Intercontinental Club, Racing, you know, were the first team to achieve that in 1967. They beat Celtic in something that was definitely seen by Racing as massively important and justified by General Onganía, the then president of Argentina, as being a national victory when they won the leg in Buenos Aires to take the third match, and when they beat Celtic in the final in Montevideo in the kind of the final playoff match. It was a huge success for the nation. What Independiente fans did after that, though, when Racing were busy celebrating, and incidentally, Independiente won the Argentinian League that year, beating Racing in one of the key games 4-0. Therefore, Independiente being able to claim that they were world champions. But prior to that, they actually managed to get into the Racing stadium and buried seven dead cats, seven black cats. They were definitely dead, you know, when they buried them anyway. We'll see afterwards. But this was the curse of the gatos negros, or the gatos muertos, and it would last a long, long time. But in that time, you know, Racing don't win anything. They get relegated to the Division B with Independiente helping them on the way and winning the league on the same day, which was a majestic moment for Independiente. Racing will come back in the, you know, a couple of years afterwards, but then they'll go bankrupt. And even in 1999, they actually were declared almost out of existence by the court at one stage. So that kind of period of, you know, 30 years of nothing, and Independiente, you know, dominating the continent and doing so and doing, you know, pretty well as well in the first division, will probably mean that the Independiente might be seen as the more successful club. I think that those Libertadores trophies certainly will carry a lot more prestige than, you know, than 18 titles, 7 of which were won in, you know, in the 1910s. Yes, you know, Racing will always say we were the first Argentinian club to win the Intercontinental, you know, but it's only one, and they've only won the Libertadores once as well. So it's worth noting, actually, that the Arsenal de Sarandí, you know, we haven't really discussed them, but, you know, they've done well continentally as well. They've won the Sudamericana back in 2007. So, you know, they're also a club that has proved themselves capable of winning on the international stage as well.
I mean, Gary, it's another... I feel like this episode, more than any other, has taken us off into so many different directions, so many discussions, which is brilliant. But again, you know, what Pete's talked about there throws up another question that's so difficult to answer, you know, and how do you measure the greatness of a club? How do you measure the superiority of a club? And it's such a subjective question to sort of ask, and, you know, and you can come up with a million different answers, you can come up with a million different sort of categories by which to judge it, but yet it's also a question that people will always ask and will always want someone to give an answer to.
Yeah, to use the old phrase, beauty isn't the height of the older. You know, and if you're a fan of Independiente, you'll think it's Independiente. If you're a fan of Racing, you'll think it's Racing, and you can justify it any way you want to. Because there is no sort of agreed measure, shall we say. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, both of these clubs are clearly, as you know, we said earlier, behemoths in the Argentine game. And I did a bit of research on both of them earlier today, and they've had some cracking names and coaches over the years. Just want to throw a few names out. So this is all fairly recent as well. So Racing have had Ardiles, Ubaldo Fiol, who people not know was the goalkeeper in the 1978 World Cup final, who Ransom Rings touch just went past him, and his star jumping hit the post and came away. And Diego Simeone, who is the club is top of the league at the moment, managed them on two occasions. And Alfio Basile, who Pete mentioned earlier, was played for them and coached them as well. And looking at Independiente, Menotti, who perhaps the most famous Argentinian coach of all time, managed them on four different occasions. And Jorge Borrachega, who scored the winning goal in the World Cup, has managed them, as has Mauricio Pellegrino, who is somebody that Pete knows particularly well. He was obviously managing...
Quality manager
in obviously in Southampton. I mean, so these are sort of, you know, major names, and it just sort of only had stature to the clubs, you know, that they've had all these legendary managers, well, legendary names as coaches, even though some of them obviously at Racing didn't last that long, given that 37 in about 20 years. I mean, the payoff for the sacking, I mean, unless they were on 6-month contracts, the payoffs must have cost the club a perishing fortune. I wonder, Pete said that they nearly went to the wall.
And again, I suppose, you know, coming to you, Stephen, obviously, you know, as a Liverpool fan, you must be in constant discussion, shall we say, about who's the greater club, Liverpool or Manchester United. I don't need you to answer.
Well, the thing is, I will answer though. It's clearly Liverpool. But that's the great thing, is that we have this saying of beard, you know, when you look at the winners of like the European Cup and the Champions League, and we will, part tongue-in-cheek, but part not tongue-in-cheek, refer to European royalty. And it's meant to be the teams that have won the trophy so many times. And because Manchester United haven't won it four times, we set the bar at four and above. So... So you're talking about, you know, from a European perspective, it's Real Madrid, it's Milan, it's Bayern Munich and Liverpool, it's Ajax, you know, it's Barcelona have crept in there, in more contemporary times. So, you know, by that rule of thumb, you know, your South American royalty, you know, Independiente are part of that. You know, they are, you know, South American royalty. Just as Boca Juniors are, Peñarol, you know, River Plate, Estudiantes would be another one because, you know, of those stars that they've won as winning the Libertadores. And then it peters out into everyone else. You know, although there's some great names beyond that. So, yes, that's why Independiente are, you know, the more globalised of the two, shall we say, because they're a recognisable name to football watchers. You know, they've tipped up in the Intercontinental Cup as a Liverpool fan. I remember getting up in the middle of the night to watch Liverpool play Independiente in 84. And we were discussing earlier about, for the recording, about, you know, that concept of there was something of the night about them, shall we say, because the gamesmanship was epic and they sneaked the goal 6 minutes into the match. Liverpool dominated the play but couldn't break down this stoic defence and, you know, and all of that. And there was something that was A, frustrating about it, but B, admirable about it as well. So even as a kid watching it and thinking it, there was some kind of artwork to the Machiavellian side of football. And I think that's where my appreciation of all forms of approach of football, you know, has come from, you know, being educated in this manner. But yes, you know, so Independiente tick all of those boxes. And in a way, it's quite, I don't know, surprising in a way, yeah, that they've not done so well over the last two decades. But within that, you know, they tick the box of the sleeping giants almost. You know, to turn around for both of these giant clubs to turn around and kind of be blindsided by Arsenal, you know, to have won that, as Pete said earlier, the Sudamericana in 2007, where they beat River Plate in the semi-finals, you know, become an international success before they were a domestic success. You know, as far as the area is concerned, they were the last champions, I think, of the area. So, yeah, notorious giants have had this upstart of a club that was only formed in 1957. You know, the two brothers that started the club, one of them, you know, Julio, went on to be the president of Independiente for a while. He you know, was president of the AFA. He went on to be a vice president of FIFA. You know, this is kind of like a club, Arsenal, of being a club that gets things done against the odds. You know, there's something utterly amazing about them. And that's why they sit so evocatively almost amidst this what should be or has been historically a duopoly. You know, even to the point that, you know, the colour of the kit that Arsenal wear, you know, it isn't an Arsenal UK, English Arsenal's colours. You know, they their colours are taken from the two giants. They were a little bit of blue, they were a little bit of red. You know, there's this great, and I think we discussed some of this when we did Asuncion, was that there are some clubs that will try and, you know, bridge the gap between two big rivals to say, look, we sit in the middle. You don't, you know, you have to, you don't have to conform by kind of like supporting one of these two giants. You can just come and support us in the middle. It's for an easier life.
From what you just said there, Stephen, what I've taken from that is that essentially Arsenal are like the Liberal Party, and that all the wrestling fans think that Manchester United is the biggest club in England. It's like I say, I mean, you know, it's brilliant. And we're already sort of, you know, over the hour, but that's okay. In terms of local derbies, we'll probably, I don't think we need to chat too much about that, as that's kind of a standard thing. But, you know, Gary set us on the road with regards to, you know, the coaches that have been involved at these two clubs. You know, and I guess, you know, again, measuring greatness, you know, you can look at the coaches that have gone there, or you can look at the players that they've produced and gone on or had their best years there as well. So, you know, again, just to sort of give us a, you know, a taste of some of the talent that has come through these two clubs.
I mean, it is. There are some real legends of the game, you know. I think that we've mentioned a couple of them in passing, and they come in different periods. But I think that they're also so entrenched within the lore of the clubs as well. You know, I think that. I mean, well, let's start with Racing. You know, in their kind of early years, you know, Alberto Acco was one of the great goal scorers of the amateur era. There was a guy called Alberto Marco Vecchio who scored 200 goals in 11 years in that kind of same period. In the kind of next strong period, you've got a guy called Norberto Tucho Mendes, who's one of the top goal scorers in the Copa America history. He won 3 Copa Americas with Argentina as well. I guess one of the great legendary figures of Racing is a guy called Omar Orbata, who was part of the Angels with Dirty Faces team, the kind of great 5 strikers. Corbata, I suppose, is the Argentine Garincha. He is this phenomenally talented winger, often seen as being the greatest Argentine right winger of all time. He was known as the Harlequin or the master of the sideline, you know, as being this kind of artist on the right-hand side who would just beat people for fun. You know, he played in the 1958 World Cup, scored 3 goals. He had an unfortunate side, much like Garincha did. He was illiterate. He used to carry around the newspaper to try and pretend that he could read. He was a renowned alcoholic. But this all emerged from a very, very impoverished background. This was a kid who wasn't schooled, you know, who lived in abject poverty. He was very small and thin to the extent that, you know, when I think he arrived at the club the first time, they asked where his suitcase was, and he said he didn't have one. He basically turned up with everything that he had. But this guy became a legend. And despite his alcoholism, despite his, you know, his problems and everything else, you know, he was the guy that gave Racing this genius for a lot of, you know, for one of their crucial periods of success. I think that we've mentioned in the kind of 1960s team, Alfio Basile was a hero. I mean, we could look at another defender called Roberto Perfumo, who is also very well known. Less so later years. I mean, Ubaldo Fillol, Gary mentioned, the great goalkeeper, was actually one of the people who turned up when the Racing had I think it was, I can't remember the numbers, someone said 100,000 people turned up and they kind of tried to do a max exorcism of the ground, and Fillol was there, and Fillol was also very important in the avoiding bankruptcy. So there's a lot of figures there. In terms of Independiente, if we go back to the early years, one of the great figures is a guy called Manuel Seoane, who was known as the Pig, because he was a bit of a large chap, and he was a hero in the 20s, and was actually the leading goal scorer in the amateur era. And there's a great fact about Manuel Seoane in that he is the first ever wearer of the Argentine number 10 shirt. And this doesn't happen in an international match, or in a kind of international match. It turned out that Third Lanark, the defunct Scottish team, were on tour in Argentina. I think it's in 1923 or 1924. And they were professional. At this time, the Argentine League isn't. And they play a game against an Argentinian 11. And the Third Lanark apparently asked for the Argentinian national team to wear numbers. And this was the first time that the Argentinian team ever did. And Seoane had the number 10 shirt and therefore was the first great Argentinian number 10, I think. If that, I read that in El Grafico, which is a very well-known kind of Argentinian magazine. So if that's true, Third Lanark were the first team to play an Argentinian team with numbers on their shirts. Anyway, so Manuel Seoane was a great forward. The next great generation there's a trio of legends. There's Antonio Sastre, there's Arsenio Rico, who we've mentioned a few times now, leading goal scorer in Argentinian league history. And the other member of the team of that striking partnership was Vicente Della Mata. Sastre is the guy that people have forgotten, though. He was named as one of the 5 greatest Argentinian players in 1980, alongside Pedernera, Di Stefano, Maradona, and Charo Moreno. He was a great playmaker. He's known, I think Menotti said that he was the best Argentinian footballer ever, you know, because he could play everywhere. He was known as the guy that invented modern football, because he could do everything. He even played twice in golf for Independiente. He went on to play in Brazil for Sao Paulo. And this was a team that, you know, hadn't won anything. They were much behind the likes of Palmeiras and Corinthians. But with Sastre playing, they won three leagues out of four. And you know, the club president said that if they ever gave a Nobel Prize for football, then all the Brazilians would vote for Sastre, because actually it was him that taught Brazil how to play football. It wasn't, you know, he was the guy that started the way that Brazil played football. That's a little bit, you know, unlikely, but that's the kind of esteem to which he was held. So Sastre is one of those great forgotten legends of Independiente. But then in much more recent years, you know, the standout player without any doubt is Ricardo Bocini, you know, a kind of small, skinny, balding guy who, you know, you would think would be much more likely to be kind of in the bookies or a clerk somewhere rather than one of the greatest footballers Argentina has ever produced. He was the master of the pause, you know, that the delayed moment where you stop, wait for everything to click and suddenly pass it and everything happens. He was known as a master of that. You know, he played for 20 years or something like that for Independiente, one club man, idolised by Maradona, some of the great partnerships like Daniel Bertoni, and, you know, almost every centre-forward who played for Independiente thrived because Bocini was the guy that was passing them the ball. So there's some absolute legends with, you know, and really fascinating stories, you know, up to the present day. You know, I mean, the likes of Sergio Aguero was an Independiente player as well. So, you know, I mean, you just go back in history and you can find all these incredible names through every single decade.
Gary, I'm not really sure what anyone else can add to that.
I just the only one I can throw into the mix there is Jose Pastoriza, who played for and coached both of the Giants, both Independiente and Racing Club. You know, he won the Libertadores as a player and as a coach. And then, you know, was the man in charge when they beat us in Tokyo in 84. You know, a player of substance, because he was Argentinian Player of the Year in 1971 as well. Yet one of those brilliant rarities of being a player of substance, but within that, because of so much talent, you know, almost overshadowed as a player despite his brilliance, yet to go on and do what he did as a coach as well. You know, so he's the only one I can throw into the ring there after Pete's brilliant eulogising of the talent of the area.
Gary, anything to add there?
I'm just humbling Pete's present, that's all I can say. I mean, that was wonderful to hear. I didn't know about Bertoni, who played with Independiente, who also played in the 78 World Cup final score. I think he scored the third goal, 78 World Cup final. We don't talk about that because we've been doing something like that. Seems to forget that. But there's some classic names that, you know, Pete reeled off there, you know, and Stevie as well. And I guess it just sort of, you know, just confirms the status of these clubs, and, you know, these are giants of the game, both players and clubs and coaches.
Yeah. Like I say, this has been, and we've still got the question, so you've got a little bit of thinking time. Well, there's not as many clubs to think about this time, but you have still got thinking time for when I parachute you all in. But as an episode, it's probably been one of the most favourite that we've done, because of all the different areas that it's, although we're, you know, this is very much a South American cities tour, it's generated so many offshoots and discussions. And to top it off with the first Argentine player to wear the Argentine number 10 shirt is just, it's brilliant. I feel like Indiana Jones when he finally finds the treasure. It's just like one of those moments. But like we say, every episode, we're in our second city. If you were seconded for work, or Gary decides to retire even further away from us all, and you are sent to Avellaneda to live, which club are you going to become a fan of? Stephen, I'll start with you first this time.
I think I'd be again, a bit like Asuncion, there wouldn't be a club I would take against as such. I would have a bone to pick with Independiente over 84. Don't get me wrong, but I admire their success on the international scene as well. So that's a double-sided coin with that one. But for me, yeah, Club Atletico San Telmo would be of interest to me, which I think Gary might go for as well here. You know, that one brief rise to the top flight of Argentinian football, never to return again in 76, you know, the defeat of Boca Juniors. You know, it also, you know, it kind of makes them the Carlisle United of Argentinian football. You know, that one rise, you know, a brief flash of brilliance, and then back from whence he came.
But Gary, are you buying a season ticket next to Steve, or are you going somewhere else?
No, I'll be sitting next to Steve in the cheap seats at San Telmo, Atletico San Telmo. I mean, interesting. I was going to describe it as the Tranmere of Merseyside compared to Liverpool and Everton, but you know, Steve Mitchell will do fine. Cole will do. But yeah, I'll go with San Telmo. You know, keep away from the big guys. Let's see some nice down to earth lower league Argentine football.
And then Pete, you know,
Steve's buying the biggest, by the way.
there's not quite so much choice here, but where are you going with the guys as well, or are you going somewhere else?
I mean, San Telmo, they're a good club, but I know I'm going to go for Sportivo Dock Sud. You know, I'm going to head down to the docks. I'm going to go back to their days of calling themselves "Follow Me If You Can" and saying, "Yeah, I'm going to follow you." I like that as a kind of idea. I like the fact that, you know, they're a club where their members did everything. They, you know, they built, you know, they put everything together. They've won the league. So we can always brag about San Telmo. If we got there, we won the league and you never did. Immediately, that's my bragging rights. Good kit, gold and blue, like that. That's a good kit. And yeah, I think that this kind of, you know, I like the idea of a kind of a club. There's a bit of football going on. There's probably a few pints and a bit of mate behind the bar in the evening as well. That seems to be a very important part of their attitude. So I think I'll be wandering along there with my scarf and my rattle thing.
Brilliant. Like I say, it has absolutely been one of my most favourite podcasts that we've done. And I was worried about that. I wouldn't even be able to pronounce where we were. just before we go, a couple of things. Stephen, have you decided which of these two clubs, which one's Roadrunner and which one's the Wile E. Coyote?
Independiente, definitely Roadrunner, just because they're off and away over the internationally. Wile E. Coyote, definitely Racing Club.
Excellent. And Gary, yeah. Do you know where we are next?
I do. I'm surprised Stephen didn't go giving Roadrunner to Racing, because he seemed a bit more speedy wise, but there you go.
I can see Racing Club with the Acme booby traps just all over the just all over the place.
In
a bid for vengeance for the ghost of the seven black cats that were buried all over the place.
Fair enough. And I would say, just agreeing with you, Stu. This has been a fantastic pod. I mean, if this is the standard for these the rest of these we're going to do, this is going to be fantastic fun. And, you know, I never thought Pete would get the Atlantic just crushing the bed to the football clubs in Avellaneda. But there you go. That's the quality of the guy. So next time we'll be travelling from the southeast to the continent, to the north, to a distance of 2,894 miles. If you don't think I've checked it, you're out of your mind. We're going to Colombia and we're going to the capital of Bogota. That'll be an interesting one.
Oof, yes, it will.
Easy to pronounce those two.
Yeah, I'm all right with that one. I don't need to start practicing the night before. but like I say, you know, guys, it's been brilliant. And I have to agree with Gary, Pete. I think you've given me my most favourite football fact of all time, I think, tonight. I've got to say, it is. I just really hope it's right.
Yeah, I hope it's right. I mean, yeah, I was praying. I tried to look it up in about five different other places and I couldn't find it, but El Gráfico is like the football magazine bible of South America. So if they're wrong, then you know, then yeah, I mean, no one should be right.
Well, so
It's on them. Right. I have absolute faith. I have absolute faith. It, like I say, my students are getting that fact tomorrow. Absolutely nailed on their game. I will give you due credit for it as well, Pete. I won't claim it as my own.
Please.
Obviously, all that's left for me to say is thank you for listening. Please join us again on our 2,891, Gary.
2,894 miles. Oh, you'd 94. Be 3 miles outside the city centre, buddy.
Okay, sorry, I just stopped off early. Yeah, as we head up to Bogota. Like I said, guys, it's been brilliant, and thank you for listening. Please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.